Welcome to the Lion's Mane Podcast, episode 27. This episode is part two of How Do We Return to Play with Dr. Nicole Sertica, a physical therapist or physio out of the LA area, and we talk about everything rehab and returning to play using the blueprint of the ACL or knee injuries. But this is applicable to anybody who's had an injury, anybody who was injured, anybody who's trying to figure out how to go through rehab, or anybody who's just interested in strength and conditioning and physical therapy. So without further ado, let's get it popping. My knee surgery was a disaster. So for anybody who hasn't had experience with the American medical system, my knee surgery was an hour and 15 minutes and cost upwards of $25,000 just for meniscus and patella little fix up. I had 6 weeks of physical therapy twice a week. And afterwards they returned me to play. And my strength coach at the time looked at me and was like, I wouldn't trust you walking up steps. You look like you're going to collapse. Yeah. It's true. It was still locking up. I was still getting that terrible popping sensation from beforehand. And I hadn't had any prep before surgery to get stronger, anything like that. I was still a weak, undertrained, training age minus one soccer player.
Yeah.
And physical therapy didn't give me any strength training. They didn't even do anything upper body for me, where my experience with RTP now with athletes is to always give, like you said, some sort of goal. Like, we can train the upper body and we can fix other stuff. It doesn't have to be, your life doesn't center around your knee injury or whatever your injury is.
Yes.
We can do other stuff. Like, the world shouldn't center
That's
around this.
Like, one of the first thing, the first time I see an athlete after an injury, say ACL injury, one of the things, or some of the questions I ask are like, what are your strengths on the soccer field? What are your strengths as a player? Mm-hmm. If they tell me that they're a center back who wins every ball in the air, you know, like a Juilliard state player, right? Yeah. Okay. I have to make sure that this person is powerful and strong when they get back onto the field. So I'm going to make sure that that's a big focus. It's going to be a focus anyway, right? Yeah. But for this player specifically, I have to make sure. Now, I also ask them, what is one of your weaknesses? What's something that you want to improve as a player? They tell me if they're a striker and they want to improve their back to goal. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to work on strength so they can hold the ball up back to goal. And we're going to work on 90-degree turns so they can turn and get a shot off. So I like to ask them those questions so that I can make it a little bit more individualized. Now, it probably won't apply until later on, but it's still good to know. And then I'll ask them, you know, obviously, what are your previous injuries? So if it's a male soccer player I'm working with and he's had a hamstring strain before, well, you better believe I'm going to be working those hamstrings, because I don't want him to go back and tear a hamstring.
Well, because it all works together. Who would have thought?
Yeah, exactly. So, and also just knowing the injury profile of the athlete's sport. So in soccer, I know that if you're a male playing soccer, because we don't have all of this data on women yet, which is a whole other issue in its entirety.
10 more years. Getting, 10 more years.
Yeah, we're getting there, but not quite there yet. So I know that any male soccer player I work with is at risk for ankle sprain, hamstring strain, adductor injury. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be training all those things. I mean, this is like an opportunity to train some of the weak links in this athlete's system. It's only going to make them a better athlete when they get back on the field. And mm-hmm. we have a 9-12 block window to do this. It's like, imagine having imagine having your athletes, you're like, hey, we're going to take a year off of playing and we're just going to better prepare you for your sport. Like, imagine having an off season that was 9 months, mm-hmm. all the things that you could do with that athlete. Like, that's the opportunity we have with long-term rehab. The danger is that we don't utilize that, and we don't load them appropriately when we just send them to physical therapy for a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the relationship between strength and conditioning coaches or performance coaches and physical therapists needs to improve. Physical therapists, mm-hmm. if you are not going to load the athletes appropriately, if you work within a setting that doesn't allow you to do that because of insurance, or if you work in a place that doesn't have a squat rack or dumbbells over 5 pounds or anything more than some TheraBands, mm-hmm. you need to be getting them involved, your athletes involved in a strength and conditioning program that they can either do in their own gym or with their coach at school. A lot of high schools will have a strength and conditioning coach.
Thank God. We're so behind on that too.
Well, I'm saying that as someone who lives in one of the more well-off communities in America.
It's coming slowly.
So a lot of these schools cost more than universities. So they have great, great staff. But like where I'm from in New Jersey doesn't necessarily have that. So finding a great strength and conditioning coach you can trust and work with to get them stronger. And that's where I think performance coaches have a hugely valuable role because they understand the demands of the sport. They understand how to prepare athletes for that. So that's where they need to come in and help out.
Totally. And you and I have talked about like our crossover point is you and I can work together, you as the physio and me as the strength coach, in when they come off the table and that first gap between, you know, I can't have you sprinting off the line yet. I can't have you going in one-on-one situations. So you and I need to work together to rehab should be a multidimensional team with the athlete at the center. In best case scenarios.
I see it as like you and me working together. And I look at the program that you have for the team and I say, okay, this athlete, instead of doing the front squat, can you just have them do a back squat today? You know, so I'm not, I'm not saying this, oh, you're front squatting and this person can't do that. So I'm just going to have them in the rehab room or in the training room.
I'm going to massage their knee.
I'm gonna put kinesio tape on and cup them while, instead of getting them stronger.
We're gonna go meditate while you guys. Actually, that might help more than
That would help more than the taping.
Yeah, totally.
So it's working together to be like, okay, this is what you're doing with the athletes today. Can we just tweak this, modify that for this athlete because of these issues that they're having, or where we're at in the rehab phase? Okay, instead of doing sprinting, if you're doing repeated sprints with the team, can you just have them do it on a bike? Mm-hmm. That way they're still getting the same training stimulus that you as the performance coach want to apply to the team and to the athletes. But I'm just saying, well, based on where they are clinically, they can't do that, but they can do this and offer an alternative.
So you're just basically doing a very specific load management.
Hey, yeah, exactly.
You want them to sprint, you want to do metabolic conditioning, can you stick them on a rower instead of having them extra volume their knee?
Exactly. Or hey, they can do sprinting, but we've only gone up to 30 yards. So if you're doing 50 yards with the team for whatever reason,
God forbid.
Oh my God. I don't know why, but if you are.
It's a football team, I guess, American football. I don't know.
if for whatever reason you're doing full field sprints.
Guys, I wish you could see the look on Nicole's face. She said that it was like 50 yards. I don't know why.
I don't know
the
why.
The weirdest look. I don't know why I said that, but.
let's make it more realistic. So let's say you're doing 20 meter sprints with the team. But this athlete, we've done, you know, up to 6 repetitions of that, but you're doing 10 with the team. Mm-hmm. Have them only do 6 and then have them go do bike to kind of make up for whatever else. So they're not quite there yet. In other words, there's some limitations on them still. So I'm going to look at your program and just, we're going to come up with a plan together for this athlete based on their limitations.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Oh my God, there's so much to this process. It's overwhelming, but and fascinating in all the right ways.
Yeah, and that's why I think it needs to be, like, I worked in a children's hospital during physical therapy school. One of my clinical rotations was inpatient children's hospital in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And the way that we decided, like, discharge, or even just, like, coming up with plans of care for the kids there, was we literally sat at a round table, and it was physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech-language pathologist.
That's awesome.
Social worker, parent, sometimes the child if appropriate, physician, nursing staff, anyone involved in this child's care sat at a literal round table, and we each gave our point of view, came up with a plan together. Now, why we don't apply that to athletes is beyond me. Like, why do we not? Granted, like, I know not every professional staff is going to have the time during the week to sit down at a round table and discuss every single player's plan of care. But how easy is it for me to just step up to you and say, hey, coach, you know, this player isn't quite there yet, or can I see what the plan is for today? And usually there are like morning meetings where they say the sports coach or the team manager says, okay, this is what we're doing today. Performance staff says, okay, well then, you know, we're going to make sure that we get some high velocity sprinting in since practice is going to be a little lighter. And then I, as a physio, sports medicine doc, can say, okay, well, this person isn't quite there yet, so can they do this, this, and that before training instead? And that's how it should be approached. And it takes 10 minutes, not even.
Yeah.
But we should always have that image in our minds whenever we're making decisions about an athlete of sitting at that round table and getting everyone's input and then coming up with a plan together.
I mean, I didn't go to physical therapy school for 5 years, so I know I should be making decisions for you. And you have your CSCS, thank God, so you could actually make decisions for me, but we can't make decisions for the head coach.
Right, exactly.
We're not doctors or physicians, so
yeah. I mean,
everybody has an expertise lane, and it suits athletes best when they can have all of those expertise people, the sports psychologists, to sit down and say, all right, here's what we're going to do to get this athlete over the finish line.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like me as the sports medicine staff or the physio saying, all right, well, they can do this and this, but I don't want them doing that. And I don't care what you say.
Right.
You know, it's, hey, I don't think that they should play more than 70 minutes in today's game. Mm-hmm. But then we get into the game and it's a tight game. And the head coach is like, hey, I need this player because if we win this, we're first in the table. And yeah. It's like, all right, well, maybe we take a little bit more risk. Or if it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's a game towards the end of the season, if it's Champions League game, right? Mm-hmm. And we say, hey, we talk to the athlete, of course, it's yeah. their decision.
Yeah.
Say, hey, I know you really want to play in this game. Ideally, I would only have you play 60 minutes today mm-hmm. Because that's what we've prepared you for. Now, I understand that this is a Champions League game and you want to contribute. I understand coach wants you to have more minutes. I need you to be honest with me during the game. And if you feel like you can't go more than 60, I need you to tell me that. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to leave it up to you, right? So if you want to play the whole 90 or if you want to play in this game, that's your call. I'm telling you that there's a bit of risk, but we can take that risk in the Champions League. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's a preseason friendly, I'm going to be a little more risk averse, right? And I'm going to say, okay, really, do you need to play in this game?
It's USA versus Costa Rica. Does she need to play 90 minutes?
Do you need to play 90 minutes of this game? Do you need to start? Can you come off the bench in the second half? But it's a conversation. It's not me dictating. It's not me saying, well, I know best, so this is what you're going to do. It's, this is what I think. This is my perspective. This is the risk we're working with. What are your thoughts? And then deciding that together.
Yeah. And that's really important and a unique way to do it though, because that was certainly not my experience when I was going through it. I don't know if it was your experience going through it. The head coach told us what the hell was going on. And so when I'm working with RTP athletes, I'm very moderate touch to the extent of I want your feedback and I want you to tell me how things are and I want you to be honest with me and I'm not going to baby you.
Yes.
So that it's kind of like that good in between of, you know, I've seen physios and strength coaches who are very high touch and kind of like helicopter parent over these injured mm-hmm. athletes. And I don't want to give them, you know, a mental piece or a story about how I, you know, need to be over controlled or this person always needs to be watching me, or maybe I'm not ready. I can't do this myself, but I also don't want them to think like I can just go balls to walls and go for it. Or the feeling that they have absolutely no control. I want them to feedback me and us decide together. So when we get in those game situations, they can turn to me as the athletic trainer or strength coach or whatever and be like, I need to come out, or this hurts. I'm feeling something different. I feel it now on my other side. I feel it on my back, where they have that proprioception and we have that relationship for them to say, I don't know,
yeah.
take me out. Maybe there's something going on.
Yeah. And it's all about, it's always all about relationships. So like,
yeah.
what do you, have you developed rapport with this athlete? Can you look at them on the field and know like, they're good, they can keep going. Or mm-hmm. do you look at them and say, I think they need to come out, and then, you know, have a conversation with them after. But it's always about knowing the athlete. And even with like, how hard can I push this person? Or are they really at their limit and now it's time for me to back off a little bit, knowing that Julie Ertz is only going down if she's really hurt.
Yeah.
So if she's down, then me as, you know, as sports medicine staff, I'm like, okay, there's something I need to look into after the game here. Yeah. Cause I know she's not going to come off unless she's bleeding yeah. and has to by the ref.
Hello. A good old Abby Wambach moment. Just staple my head up. I'm good.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Michelle Akers getting IVs during halftime.
Oh my God. She was insane though. That was another story. Nuts. She's
literally
incredible.
Nuts. But it is all about the relationship you have with your athletes. And we, like you said, like, if you are just constantly giving like constant feedback to the athletes, you are not empowering them to do anything for themselves. We're not empowering them to feel confident in their own bodies. Yeah. And then as we get closer, maybe we start to take away a little bit of that feedback, still let them know that we're there every once in a while. And the type of feedback too, that's another thing that we can manipulate during the rehab and performance training process. Instead, we know that when we're coaching a new or a novel movement task, if we just strictly say, okay, knees over toes, like, what is, like, okay, I have to look at my knees now, make sure they go past my toes.
So specific.
Yeah, when you learned how to ride a bike, did anyone say to you, all right, you're going to pull your knee up, it's that you're in hip flexion, and then you're going to push down through your toes into the pedal yeah. while your other leg. Nobody told it to you like that. They just said, get on the bike and go and figure yeah. it out. So we need that implicit learning to occur.
Yeah.
And the way that we can help drive that, so essentially what that means is we want automaticity. So we want them to step onto a field and not have to think about the steps required to perform a movement task. We don't want them
advanced
to land
stages of learning. Yeah,
exactly. We don't want them to land from a head ball and think, okay, make sure I land in a squat, you mm-hmm. know, get more than 30 degrees of knee bend.
And now I'm going to push off with my left foot and drive my right forward.
Yeah. We don't necessarily want that. So the way that we can help train that is by giving them, external cues. So something mm-hmm. outside of their bodies. And like I said, like a metronome is a great way to start with that. Not having them stare in a mirror all the time. Maybe we give them a mirror initially, but we have to take that away, right? We have to progress away from standing in front of a mirror and squatting and staring at your kneecaps.
Yeah.
Also a great thing to do is, with feedback, so I like to say, that rep was perfect. Make the rest of them just like that. So now mm-hmm. they know it's good because athletes respond better to positive feedback yes. than negative.
Yeah.
I think most humans do, but the research has been done in athletes. Yeah. So we respond better to positive feedback. So, hey, that rep was great. Now, however that felt for you, however you decided to do that movement, just replicate that. Mm-hmm. So now it's implicit learning. Implicit feedback, and also it's positive reinforcement of yeah. a good movement task.
Yeah, I do the same. And then I ask, hey, what did you do on that one? What did you change? What were you thinking? How are you feeling? Mm-hmm. And make them quickly reflect, what was I doing? I mean, we tend to be humans for our brain power are so unself-aware. Like we are so not aware of what we think, what we feel. And in rehab, I mean, like you said, when you get down to the neuroscience of the matter, even when it comes down to pain, and we'll get to that in a second, that's my last question. Mm-hmm. We have no idea what's actually going on in our bodies or in our brains unless we're purposefully thinking about it. So that self-feedback can really help in rehab scenarios. And it's a chance to step back out of the noise, just be one-on-one with yourself or with your physio or strength coach and actually think, what do I feel when I do a squat? It might be the first time you ever focused on how your body feels when you squat, what contracts, what doesn't. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. And like, there's still, even when I train now, there's days where I'm like, okay, I'm going to go lighter. Like right now I've programmed myself. So I'm doing Bulgarian split squats and, I have noticed, and it's something that's bothered me that, I have an asymmetry and I always end up shifting load out of my yeah. knees and into my hips. So I have a block where I'm going lighter, a training block mm-hmm. where I'm lighter in my Bulgarian split squats so that I can have a little bit better of like a mind muscle connection, as mm-hmm. lame as that term can be sometimes.
It works though.
So I can really like hone in and think about it. And then the goal is that eventually as I progress, I don't need to think about it anymore, is that mm-hmm. it becomes automatic. But initially I do need to. I need to think about that and think, okay, are my hips level? Am I keeping my weight going forward into my knees? Am I driving my
You're relearning.
Forward? Exactly. Yeah. So initially I may need to learn it that way and think about it that way. And then the goal is that in my next training block, I can start going heavy again using that pattern I've just learned instead of going back into my hips. So that's just like a self-example of how we can do that.
Totally. I love it. I love going through the phases of learning with athletes and watching them not have to cue themselves, not me not having to cue them, the quick self-correction, and then having to have no correction at all because they've self-feedback so much. Yes. And done 1,000 reps.
That's one of my favorite things is seeing when an athlete self-corrects. I try not to say anything until like the fourth or fifth rep of something, unless that's how many we're doing, and then I'll say it sooner, the next set. But I try not to say anything the first couple of reps and see if they self-correct.
Exactly.
Not initially, when they're still new to the program, then I'll interject a little sooner. But once I've been with them for a little while, are they going to self-correct or are they not? If they don't, then I'll step in and say something after the fact. But if they do, it's such a great, I applaud that. I'll be like, hey, you self-corrected. That was awesome. Like whatever correction you made, start off that way now.
Yeah. I just had an athlete 2 weeks ago switch for the first time from split squats to rear elevated or Bulgarians. And she got in there, I didn't like the shin angle at all, but I left her alone for three reps, knew it wouldn't hurt her, left her alone. Yeah. And on the second rep, she self-corrected, this doesn't feel right. And she put her foot out a little bit. Perfect, beautiful shin angle. I was like, yes, see, you know what you're feeling.
Exactly.
That's good for us to see.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Absolutely. I want to know your thoughts about pain. How much of pain can you take away? Actually, there's a difference between pain and discomfort and muscle soreness. Yeah. We know that. Yeah. It's important to differentiate. How much pain are you actually capable of taking away, and how much pain is the athlete responsible for?
So I'll start off by saying that what the guideline I give, and the rule of thumb that I give my athletes is, if you're on the soccer field and you're focusing only on your pain to the point that you can't focus on what's going on the field, then that's not a tolerable amount, and that's when you need to come off. So if it's messing with your performance, that should be a no-brainer, right? Mm-hmm. So come off the field because you're not performing your best. So why even be there? You're not performing your best, so come on off. Yeah. If it's something that you're consciously aware of, to the point that as you're chasing down a ball, that's what you're thinking. Instead of you're chasing down a ball and you're scanning the field and thinking, where's my opponent? Am I going to play an early cross, or am I going to take it to the end line and send it back? Then that's what I tell my athletes, that's a scenario that I would advise you come off. Mm-hmm. Now, as far anything below that, I don't think it's realistic to have athletes go into the field and never have pain or discomfort. If that was my job, if that was my role as a sports physical therapist, to have all my athletes go into the field 100% pain free, I wouldn't have a job. Yeah. I'd be fired real quick.
Yeah.
And I think most high level athletes are inherently aware of that, right? They know,
it's part of the game.
This is bothering me a little bit, but I'm fine. I think that most athletes are, youth athletes tend to not be aware of that because I think they get a lot of mixed messaging from their coaches, parents, whoever else.
Our strength coach once told us there's a difference between being hurt, injured, and effed up. And when you're injured versus effed up, you really need to take a look at yourself and self-reflect. But everybody's always hurt if you're an athlete.
Yeah. Everyone's going to have some level of discomfort. I tell my athletes, there's not a day that goes by when I'm walking around that I'm not sore from my training session, right?
Totally.
Or that I'm, that I don't notice something in my body. Now, maybe I'm hyper aware because of my career. But that doesn't mean I'm going to be I can't train today because this is a little bothersome.
Yeah.
I know that I'm fine, so I do it.
Let me put myself through a 6-week rehab cycle because my Achilles is a little irritated today.
We can't expect to have people be 100% pain-free 100% of the time. Because pain is actually a good thing. And this is the whole role of pain is a much larger, much more complex conversation that I'm still grappling with.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. And I don't think we'll ever really come to a firm conclusion on what it means because it's so subjective. And there's so many things that play into it. So if you had a crappy night of sleep, if you didn't eat well the night before, if you were drinking the night before, if you are feeling a little under the weather, your tolerance or your threshold for having a painful experience is going to be different. Mm-hmm. So all of those things can play a factor. If you had a fight with your significant other, if you're stressed about paying the bills, if you got laid off last week, you know, all of those things can contribute to how much of a pain experience you're going to have. So it's really egomaniacal of me to go in and think that I'm going to fix all of that, right? Like, yeah. I'm going to fix your life.
Like, totally.
That, I don't think that that's realistic. And I try, yeah. I think that we fail people when we tell them, that the whole point in going to physio is to get out of pain. Like, that's not, I don't see that as my job. I don't see my job to be to get you out of pain. I see my job to help guide you through an injury so that you can get back to doing what you love.
Yeah.
And sometimes that requires pain. You know, there's some good research on muscle injuries needing some painful stimuli to kickstart the healing process and create positive tissue adaptation.
The obstacle is the way. What?
Yeah. We got to go over it, not around it. Yeah. Now, of course, there are times that we're going to modify things and I don't want increased pain. So in the example of somebody with an ACL injury who had a patella tendon graft, maybe initially I'm not going to have you do forward walking lunges because it's just like sharp increases in patella tendon pain every time you take a step. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe I'm going to modify it, still try to get a similar training effect. So maybe we're going to do split squats instead because it's less of a forward momentum, less strain through the patella tendon. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we're going to do an isometric, or maybe we're going to do reverse lunges because that's even less. Cause now we have a backward momentum instead of forward. So there's always, sometimes we do need to modify things in the presence of pain. But I think with elite level athletes, thinking that our job is to eradicate pain is a massive error.
I couldn't agree more, because one thing that I immediately noticed when I started getting into neuroscience after my bachelor's and really, this doesn't add up. This whole, like, how do we rehab athletes? This from a mental perspective doesn't add up. What's the missing link? And pain and stress essentially follow a lot of the same pathways through the brain and body. And essentially they are a reaction to a disruption in homeostasis. Like, mm-hmm. the body's like, or the brain is, I'm sensing something in the environment, or in this case, maybe in the body, that is off from what it usually is, and I'm sending out an alarm system. And yeah, so I always tell my precisely. Athletes, cool, it's an alarm system. So take a second, come back, think, what's going on? Am I in physical danger? No. Where's the pain in my body? Here. What do I feel around that? Is it just discomfort? Because a lot of times we don't realize that it's just discomfort, or it just was a little zinger one time and it's not staying. Especially if we're scared of re-injury. The mind plays such a huge role.
Yeah. And that's such a great way to educate your athletes about it, right? Like, it's an alarm system. That's truly what it is. Imagine a life where there is no pain, right? Mm-hmm. You'd get hit by a car, have internal bleeding, but it doesn't hurt. So you keep going.
And there are people like that and they die very quickly.
Exactly. Exactly. Or they have to live their lives like in a bubble because they have no internal feedback, no internal barometer of like, hey, pay attention to this.
Yeah. The feedback loop is broken.
Exactly. And that's all it is. It's just, like you said, it's an alarm system, like bringing conscious awareness to something happening in your body. And we can say that it's not always the most accurate alarm system either. Right. So, true. Think about,
because it also protects your psychology. It also protects your ego.
Exactly. So like, think of something like a paper cut, very minimal tissue damage, a lot
hurts
of pain.
Like hell. Yeah.
So it's an alarm system like, hey, there's something wrong here. But it's vastly disproportionate to the amount of damage. So pain for sure plays a role in alarming you to something. But like you said, take a step back and think about it, be mindful about it, and then reassure yourself, okay, this isn't something to panic about. It's just a paper cut, calm down, rinse it out, wash it, and you're good. But so that's what's called like SIMS and DIMS. So DIM is danger in me, SIM is safety in me. So your body, your nervous system perceives a threat or a DIM, danger in me. Now, if you can go back and think about it and be mindfully aware of it and say, okay, my knee is bothering me, but this has happened before and I was fine, so I'm not too worried about it. Or I did a lot of Bulgarian split squats yesterday trying to load my knee. So, hey, yeah, it's a little uncomfortable today. Totally fine. That creates SIMS, safety in me. So we can also create safety in me. Like I said, if in a rehab program, someone's having pain with a certain movement, they're having pain with front squats. All right, so let's do it to a box. So that is creating safety, right? You're just sitting down and standing up. You just happen to have a barbell across your chest.
But that changes the awareness. It requires so much awareness and proprioception.
It changes the perception in the nervous system of, is this a threat or am I okay?
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. Oh my God, there's so much to talk about. But how do we deal with, how do athletes who are just returning to play, and this is a question I get a lot, so I'll leave you with this. How do athletes who are returning to play deal with feeling like their body part is different?
Yeah, and that's a common thing. And especially like after an ACL injury, there's a lot of players who will say that in their first season back, like they feel fine, but they really feel like themselves again in their second season back. And I'd say in my own experience too, with my leg getting back, I think at first I was still like, oh, my leg is a little bit different. It still doesn't feel the same. I think a big thing is like why we do objective testing during return to sport, and why we have that nice lengthy process and that continuum of return to performance is that they can, even if they feel that way, they can maybe like, again, be mindfully aware and say to themselves, I know it doesn't feel right just yet, and that's okay, but I'm not broken. And I can continue to do this, and I'm going to be okay. Now, if it's something that it's a new sensation or it comes up unexpectedly and you go back and think about it and you're like, I don't know where this is coming from, maybe that's something that we need to evaluate and consider. But I think knowing that it's normal to not feel normal is big and helps give a little bit of relief to athletes and say like, hey, you might not feel normal for your first season, but as long as you feel safe, as long as I can show you, hey, you're just as strong, if not stronger on that side compared to the other side, you're just as strong, if not stronger than you were before the injury. Your performance levels, your sprinting speed is faster than it was before the injury. Having that objective data, I think does a lot to calm athletes' nerves and say, all right, maybe it doesn't feel right, but I'm performing well and I'm not at any more risk than I was before the injury. So
getting that confidence up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I always tell my athletes that it's your normal is a new normal and that's okay. It doesn't mean that you're at risk for re-injuring it just because, you know, it feels different or that it's lax because it feels different or something.
And that's the importance of having that objective data. Like I think a lot of times the pendulum can swing too far one direction and we say like, well, it doesn't matter what, you know, what their imaging says, which like for the vast majority of people, yeah, it doesn't, probably doesn't always matter what your imaging says. But if that image showing that there's nothing wrong with the tissue helps the athlete overcome it and get back on the field, then it's helpful, then it's beneficial. Yeah. Or if, you know, do I need to do single leg hopping tests? It doesn't tell me much about whether they're ready to play soccer or not. But I can say to the athlete, hey, you're just as good as on the side as the other side. I can see that they're not hesitating to jump off that and land on that single leg, or that they are, and then we need to address it. So it tells me more information, and there's still value in getting objective measurements. Totally. And that's why I think as humans, we're hardwired to be like, hey, this is showing me that I'm okay, so I can move past that. The danger is just, then we
only
can't
relying on that.
Only relying on that. And then also, what if like the scan does show something and it's like, oh, but you're still fine.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not your imaging.
Yeah, exactly. Don't listen to Instagram. It's not all about the photo. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. There's so much to rehab. So tell the people again where they can find you if they have questions, I know you do some online stuff as well, if they decide that they need that out of network physical therapist.
Yeah, so I do have a couple clients that I work with remotely online because they live in more remote areas and don't have access to a sports physical therapist. So I help people rehab from injuries, whether you live in LA or if you live in Italy where you can't go see a doctor right now because you're quarantined. And who knows with the coronavirus, hey, if you can't get to a gym and you want to do some rehab and they're shut down, I do it online. So
see,
hit me
online
up.
Coaching is about to take a hit here. Let's
it
go.
Really is, yeah. Telehealth, here I come.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I do remote online. I also do in person. Because I'm out of network and cash based, I tend to see people after they've gone through the insurance model. But I also have people who I see right after surgery who don't go through the insurance model. Mm-hmm. So I like to do that. I also, like I said, I'm a performance coach. I like to use that to help me see the bigger picture and make sure I'm preparing athletes appropriately for their sport after an injury or in the presence of an injury. But also if you just want to do some performance training, you know, I have clients that just do that too. So I like to do that. But yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Dr. Nicole PT. It's Dr. period Nicole PT. I'm on Twitter at NCertica Physio. My website is NicoleCerticaPhysio.com. I know no one's going to know how to spell my last name. It's S-U-R-D-Y-K-A. And then I have a podcast that you've been on.
Yeah, Complete Football Health.
Yep. I write a blog every Monday, so that's on my website. And I put out YouTube videos every Wednesday, sometimes Saturdays as well. So go ahead and check that out.
And you got and ebooks too.
I have ebooks, right? I put ebooks on. So I teach a course called Managing the Uninjured Soccer Player, and it's a course for physical therapists, athletic trainers, performance coaches, sport coaches, soccer players. I've had soccer mm-hmm. players attend as well. And it goes, day one goes through all of the most common injuries in soccer, like their mechanisms of injury, risk factors, things like that, and then rehab principles for those injuries. And then day two is return to sport decision making and testing, physiological demands of the sport, programming from rehab to performance, injury risk reduction programs, on-field rehab. So I teach that, and each section of that course I am putting into its own designated ebook and releasing them on a monthly basis. So right now, the January ebook was my principles of rehab and performance training. So that's just my overarching principles, how I approach each athlete, and that's a free download on my website. The ankle ebook is available online. It's less than $7.50, so like
buy it.
I mean, there's I really can't make it much cheaper than that for the amount of time that went into it. Yeah. So that, again, it has everything you need to know about ankle injuries and soccer players, sample rehab progressions and exercise progressions. So you can check that out. This month at the end of March will be the medial knee injury or MCL mm-hmm. injury ebook, which is the most common knee injury in soccer players. Next month, April, will be ACL, and then I'll just keep going through all the sections for the rest of the year. So head over to my
cranking
website.
It out, man.
And check them out. Yeah, and then take my course. My course right now is only in person, but by the end of the year, I will be putting it online.
I'm pretty excited about that because I've never managed to get to a course.
I'm excited about it too because I do love to travel and I love to meet people in person, but I can't get everywhere, right? I have people like from Sri Lanka asking me to teach the course there. I'm like, I'm not going to fly there for three people in Sri Lanka to take my course.
Exactly.
I can't fly to Nebraska for two people to sign up, right? Yeah. Like, so in more remote areas, you can still take the course just online.
Yeah. That's dope though, to get the practical hands-on stuff. If you can get to LA or Cary, or you did a US tour last year, right?
Yeah. Yeah. This year I'm scheduled to go to Bozeman, Montana in May. Mm-hmm. And I'm finalizing dates for Houston, Texas and the DC area. And then I'm always down to do more. Just let me know if you have turf and some open space at your clinic.
I didn't actually know more than three people lived in Montana. So that's good to know.
Yeah, and actually that's where like my remote online clients are, is Montana.
Oh, nice. What's up, Montana? No shade, homie. I just, what up? I Google Maps it once and was like, wow, this looks like a lot of land. Okay.
It is a lot of land.
Well, Nicole, thank you so much for coming on. This is going to be two episodes in two parts. So it's a lot of information. Thank you for sharing from the bottom of your heart. So I appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me on, Julia. I appreciate it.